Given the Illinois budget, or non-budget as the case may be, it is weighing on a lot of minds right now how various agencies and programs might be impacted. But whether dependent on state funding, private foundations, or just passing the hat $1 at a time, people, plenty of people, depend on community organizations every single day. And especially important is it to protect and serve the most vulnerable in our communities. Specifically, I mean children. No matter how you feel about school lunches, organic food, free breakfast programs, gun violence, global trade, poverty, racism, sexism, science, healthcare, or the Illinois budget crisis, I think we can all agree that every single child deserves and has the right to food, shelter, education, safety, health, joy, and love. And every day in communities around the world, and right here in Chicago is no exception, of course, for some children, through no fault of their own, those needs are simply not met. Sometimes needs take the form of basic things that many of us take for granted: safety, food, shelter, clothing, and care. And sometimes they take other forms, like access to books and other learning tools, even encouragement. Tonight, we're taking a look at organizations right here in Chicago doing grassroots work one young person at a time to help ensure that happens, that as many children as possible have what they need, ranging from basic necessities to community support and encouragement. So tonight, the politics don't matter, and it's not productive to blame anyone anyway. Tonight, what does matter is the work being done by people we'll speak with who are behind organizations helping kids to be their best. Indeed, preparing for tonight's show, I found a dizzying number of wonderful people and organizations doing amazing and impactful work in Chicago and beyond. We cannot possibly represent everyone, but tonight we'll talk with four people from four organizations doing this very important work, stretching resources and helping serve children in Chicago and far, far beyond. I'm Amy Guth, and that's all coming up tonight on the Saturday Night Special.
Live from the biggest small town in America,
this is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout Mid-America.
Radio? Well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
720 WGN, you heard the woman. This is the Saturday Night Special, and I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us tonight. I'm very grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. So tonight on the program, we're going to be talking with people behind four different organizations that are all devoted to helping underserved or underrepresented young people. We're going to talk with an organization called Bernie's Book Bank, which is devoted to providing young people with books 12 years at a time. Another, I Grow Chicago, which aims to foster creativity, wellness, and empowerment for kids through educational programs, mentorship, and sustainable farming right here in the city. And with the Chicago chapter of Engineering for Kids, which helps nurture STEM education for kids, especially for girls. And we will talk with the leader of Corporate Accountability Lab, an organization based here in Chicago who fights for extremely vulnerable children in situations around the globe. So we have a lot to do tonight, a lot to do, a lot to discuss, and a lot to learn and hear tonight. And we have a pretty packed show, so I cannot swear that we're going to be able to take too many calls, but 312-981-7200, an esteemed producer, Tom Hush, will be the voice on the other end of the line if you do have a comment or question for one of our guests. And of course, you can find me on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'll be right back to get this conversation underway on 720 WGN.
All right.
WGN, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with me tonight. Appreciate you for sharing part of your evening with me. So as ever, we pick one big topic and we talk about it all night. And tonight on the program, we're going to be looking at some local organizations that are working very hard to serve the needs of the most vulnerable of our population, and that is children. As I said before the break, there's many ways you can think about the different issues that put a child in a disadvantaged situation. But you know what? At the end of the day, let's just help kids, because I think we can all agree that all children deserve a chance. And so we're going to be talking with people tonight who are doing just that and serving the youngest, the most vulnerable of our population, and doing really interesting and wonderful work to help children right here in Chicago. So we're joined right now by phone. We are with Brian Floriani, who is the founder and executive director of Bernie's Book Bank. Welcome to the program, Brian.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us tonight. I appreciate you taking time to talk with us on a what I'm sure is a busy holiday weekend.
No problem.
I really wanted to tell listeners about Bernie's Book Bank, because the mission is really so lovely. And as you dig into the organization, and everybody can read about it, berniesbookbank.org, you can read this wonderful story. This is something you created really to honor a legacy that your father created and instilled in you.
Yeah, I mean, it's named after my dad, but it really, the objective of the organization is to solve a solvable problem, and one that impacted him greatly. I mean, my dad grew up in western Pennsylvania. His father was a coal miner for 51 years. My dad didn't have running water until he went to college, and very similar to a lot of children, hundreds of thousands of children in Chicagoland, but millions all over the country who really, they just need a fair shot, as you referenced. And for children, regardless of where they start, we all literally read our way to a better life. And that means that we need to have quality children's books in our home from the time we're born, to get us reading ready, and then foster that love of reading, and so we can become reading proficient, and really have a chance at a legitimate shot. And so, go ahead. Sorry, Amy.
No, go ahead. I was just going to ask how you do that, I think, is so wonderful, by providing books to children so they have books in the home.
Right. So we take on one very specific challenge. And literacy is a huge team sport. And just like food insecurity, there's book insecurity. And it's really not a matter of supply at all. It's simply a matter of logistics. The supply of unutilized children's books, new and used, well outweighs the demand. It's simply a matter of logistics. And how do you acquire them in mass, process them quickly, and then distribute them in a sustainable way? And I think that's the key here, is to making sure that we're replicating the delivery of quality books to these homes, just like maybe you and me owned books as children. I know for me, I mean, I own books in mass from the time I was born up till today. And so we're really trying to replicate that for children all over Chicagoland, and then replicate in every major city in the country. And so we're just there to help support all the great work that's being done in the literacy field, whether it's in school or after school or prevention or intervention, for-profit, nonprofit, just to make sure that all the work that's being done is being supported by quality book ownership in the home.
And tell me about the significance of the number 12. That plays a big role in your organization, too.
Yeah, good question. So we serve children from birth through sixth grade, or 0 to 12 years old, with 12 quality books a year. And so from birth through sixth grade, that would be 12 quality books, 144 books hand-delivered to each at-risk child in Chicagoland. Currently, we're serving 330,000 children that way. With the idea being by the end of next year that we'd be serving every at-risk child in Chicagoland that way. That's in all six counties, with 12 quality books a year, every year from birth through sixth grade.
That is such a wonderful, I love that goal is very achievable in your mind. I think that's so wonderful. And this really started in not that long ago, in 2009. And it sounds like it started quite easily and simply in your garage.
Yeah, well, that's how everything starts, right? I mean, I think you have to have a vision. You have to be very clear on what you're trying to achieve. I think in my case, I was just naive enough to get into the nonprofit world at a time where you could argue it was probably the worst time in history to start a nonprofit. But because of my experience in the schools for 2 years up in Zion, to me, this must be done. And I really think in general, literacy and education, I really think that we all need to focus our attention and to focus our resources a lot more in this area, because if you think about a lot of the society's ill wills, whether it's homelessness, poverty, what have you, a lot of it stems from the fact that these children and these people were not given a fair shot from an educational standpoint. And really, that's their only ticket, isn't it? I mean, and that's why I'm so passionate about it, because if it wouldn't have been for education and for being a good gatherer of information, my dad wouldn't have gotten to where he was as a director of reading instruction for the state of Delaware, putting three of us through college. And that was in one generation. And he's not really unique. Who he represents are millions of people that came before him. But who he really represents to me today and to our organization are these children who, if you give them a legitimate shot from the beginning, they will get their way to a better life. But if they show up to school and they don't know what a book is and they're not reading ready, the chances aren't very good. And then that impacts us all.
Yeah, indeed. And so what do you wish more people knew about literacy that perhaps is often missing from the dominant narrative around it?
Right. Well, I think that literacy is the most important skill any of us will ever have. I mean, no matter what our profession is, we literally read our way to a better life. And we hear a lot about health literacy and financial literacy. If you don't have literacy, you don't have either one of those either. And it's the basic building block for education. And I really wish that we as a society would really shine the light much brighter on the education in general, right? And if you're going to be educated, you're going to need to be reading ready and literate. And what I find very encouraging is, if you think about reading readiness, and I define that, or it's defined as knowing your letters, your numbers, knowing what a book is when you show up to school, or you're already reading at 6 years old. If you think about that and all of the children that have been reading ready throughout the course of history, how many of their parents are reading specialists? Less than half of 1%. So the beautiful thing is, that's not a very complicated equation. We know how we make that happen, so we need to focus our attention on that. Where it becomes very complicated is when children enter school and they're not reading ready.
Right.
And I saw this firsthand, and I was blown away by how many children just in Zion were showing up to school not reading ready, and then how that impacted their educational journey, their pursuit of happiness, and then how that impacts us all. And so for me, if we all understand how important it is, I wish we would start putting our focus and our attention and our resources towards making sure that all children, regardless of where they came from, was provided a great education, and reading is a huge part of that.
Hear, hear. Well, on your website, there is a really great list. If you go to berniesbookbank.org/about, there's a great list of how people can get involved, because I know that's what listeners are thinking right now. They're like, sold. How do I help? And what's really the first one that really stuck out to me was how easy it is to support your organization. So for $6, you can basically sponsor a year of books for one child, which is a very low entry point.
That's right. So we take a lot of pride in being efficient and making sure that there's a huge return on investment. And so we hold ourselves accountable. And so we're able to collect, process, and distribute each book for less than 50 cents a book. And when you look at how do you engage with Bernie's Book Bank, we're really looking for three things to fill, these three pipelines to fill at all times. That's books, volunteer, time, and, of course, funding. And we work really hard to provide opportunities that fit you, and to really understand what you're trying to do as a donor, whether it's big, whether it's small, whether it's time, whether it's money, whether it's books, so that we become much more than your charity. And I think that's one way that we have built the family of supporters that we have. I mean, we do 6,000 volunteer hours a month at our facility now. And that's all ages and abilities. And I want to stress that all ages and abilities, because we take children of all ages. And so for if you're looking for a great, impactful, easy way to help, but do it as a family, Bernie's Book Bank is a great option for you.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. Everybody, head to berniesbookbank.org. You can find out more about this organization that provides books at no cost to children who need them. And it's 12 books a year for 12 years. That's such a wonderful start and such a wonderful educational gift for children for literacy. So everybody, head to that website. It will be on the WGN Radio website also, and I'll be sure to tweet that link out. So Brian Floriani, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you. And happy birthday to America, right?
Indeed. Thanks so
much. Okay.
All right. Have a good night. All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff. Back in just a bit, we are talking tonight on the program all about organizations right here in Chicago that are serving young Chicagoans, all about kids tonight. So back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. As ever, we pick one big topic and we talk about it all night long. And that topic tonight is programs for kids, because there are so many children all around the world that need help and support, and they are indeed the most vulnerable of the population. And tonight we're taking a look at some organizations right here in Chicago that are doing really, really impactful, important grassroots work. Child by child. Really, really interesting and important work that we are talking about tonight. And so thank you for being with us. And again, we are going to put links to all of these organizations we're talking to, with, and about. We're going to put them all up on the WGN Radio website, and I'll tweet them out and share them on Facebook too, so everybody can be in touch and support all of these wonderful organizations. We are joined in studio now by a very special guest. We have Quentin Mables with us. He is the co-executive director of an organization called iGrow Chicago. And this is an organization I've been familiar with for a little over a year, and they do so much. You do so much work, Quentin. You do so many things out of this organization and support so many people. So welcome to the program tonight.
Thanks for having me, Amy. I appreciate it.
So tell us about iGrow for someone who perhaps hasn't heard of the organization, about what you do, where you're located, and who you're serving.
Well, again, thanks for having me, Amy, and hello to everyone who's tuned in. iGrow is a 501c organization, and it's actually been around since 2013. But iGrow is a place where you can come and just be you, you know, for all the kids, for adults,
and there's
for
everyone. There's a facility that you call the Peace House.
Yes, ma'am, correct. And the Peace House was established actually in 2013. It was a house that was up for demolition. Our founder, Robin Carroll, she purchased this home, and we renovated, you know, taught. Again, we got these life skills, myself, and my friends, and everyone. Like, it was from the two-year-olds to
everybody was pitching in.
Exactly. Everyone had a helping hand of making this house to where it is today.
And when you say you renovated it, let us be clear. You don't mean you hired somebody. You did the work. You were doing all of it yourself, and really a community effort to make this community center.
Yes, of course. Yeah, I mean, I had zero to little experience in, you know, putting in towel or put down the floor, putting in a dishwasher. Like, I had no skill set of this to this magnitude. But we worked alongside of the contractors, and we then began to get life skills from that. You know, myself and a lot of more of my friends, we got a skill set. You know, some of my friends didn't know they had this skill. You know, I knew I didn't have it because it just wasn't in me, you know. We all built for different things. But again, some of my friends had the skill set and they didn't get a chance to expose it or explore the skill set, you know, at a job per se. So when the Peace House was built, they found their skill set. It was great.
Indeed. And if you have been to this place, you will be so charmed by it. It is a bright and happy and beautiful spot. And there's farming programs, there's yoga,
yes, yes.
There's all this wonderful community building action happening. There's even art and all this. We're going to talk about some of the programs here in a little bit. But tell me about what this house means to the community in which it sits.
Well, I mean, it's a sense of ownership, Amy, because, again, everyone had a helping hand in forming this, what we call the Peace House today. You know, it's a vital piece, you know, to the community that is Inglewood, you know, and throughout the city. You know, we have people from every facet of the rural coming in and throughout those doors. So, I mean, being able to touch those individuals with the type of work that we're doing, and also especially for the kids, you know, and there is farming, yoga, which I take place into each and every day when I can. I love yoga, so it's been a good tool to have at my disposal. And yeah, with the farming, you know, there's a huge community garden directly across from the site, and you know, the neighbors of anyone, if you're traveling anywhere, you could come and get some mustard greens, some collard greens, some you know, basil, some dill, free of charge. It's there, it's growing. Now, I'm not the one growing it. Shout out to our master gardener by the name of Ken, but I help him sometimes, you know. I got to get my farming down
sure
a little bit, but yeah, I mean, again, and it's just a place where everyone can be themselves. We have job resume programs where we help the youth you know, apply for different jobs throughout the city of Chicago and throughout the world. So I mean, again, this is a resource, and it's just a step in the right direction. Yes,
well,
ma'am.
Well, you know what, I'm really struck by, if you follow I Grow Chicago on social media, which everyone should do, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, the Instagram especially. I love that Instagram because, you know, there is a lot of times, I think, with so many issues in the world, there's a dominant narrative of what people think about, whether it's a neighborhood or an issue or something. And mm-hmm. I think sometimes when people are talking about Inglewood, beautiful, lovely community projects get kind of lost in a dominant narrative and kind of buried under yeah. other headlines. And this is a beautiful community. And there's all these like wonderful like kids that have accomplished these cool things that are often lost in the main news stories.
Yeah, of course. You know, individuals, you know, tend to turn a blind eye to such a beautiful community. And we want to show everyone that this, with an opportunity, what can be gained from an opportunity. You know, that's all it takes. That's all anyone is asking for, you know, as an opportunity to do great. You know, you give an individual an opportunity, you know, to provide, to put food on a table, you know, to put the comfort in their homes. So, I mean, again, an opportunity, and that's where it comes from, and that's what, you know, Inglewood needs. We all need an opportunity to show our skill set and that we could be great.
Indeed. You know, as I said at the top of the program, that, you know, no matter how you feel about the politics around an issue or science or healthcare or the cause of poverty or anything, what really at the end of the day, at least tonight on this show, really what we're aiming at is that all kids deserve a chance.
Yes, of course. You know, every kid deserve a chance.
No matter what their circumstances are, right?
No matter what. And also, again, with the resources. So even with the lack of resources that is provided for a community such as Inglewood, you know, and that's just one of many, but the community I lived in my entire life, you know, so with the lack of resources that's been thrown into Inglewood, we're just showing you we have perseverance, you know, no matter what. No matter what the challenges we face with, we can we will strive for greatness no matter what. You know, of course, Inglewood, you know, got this narrative in which, in fact, some might say, hey, don't go to Inglewood. You know, you'll be shot, you'll be robbed, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, but when you come into Inglewood, Inglewood is just like your north area. You know, there's people there who raising families, beautiful kids, beautiful families. Again, we just looking for that opportunity. And with that opportunity, we can show you that no matter what, we can be great.
Indeed. So we are talking with Quentin Mables, who is the co-executive director of I Grow Chicago. You can find out about this organization at igrowchicago.org. There are so many programs that are so wonderful. And again, connect on social media, especially Instagram. It's one of my favorite Instagram accounts. Just so much happiness and positivity there. We need to take a little break, but when we come back, I want to talk about your particular journey into yoga, because when you say yoga is available there, it's not just yoga is available there. You're in fact really living and walking a very yogic life, and in fact helping others become yoga certified, teaching even very young children about meditation and mindfulness and yoga, which I think is so lovely. So we'll talk about that when we get back. We're going to take a quick break. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Mm-hmm. 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. And tonight's big topic that we're talking about, the whole program, is all about grassroots organizations right here in Chicago that are doing wonderful and very important work to support young people in Chicago. Really, really important programs and organizations that we're talking to. And again, we're going to be tweeting out links to everybody that we're talking with tonight, and so that you can be sure and get involved. And we will be putting some links up on the WGN Radio website so you can find and support and donate and volunteer and all those things you want to do. We're hanging out in studio with Quentin Mables, who is the co-executive director of iGrow Chicago. And this is an organization I've been familiar with for about a year, doing really, really important work and also very, very positive and uplifting work. I was talking before the break about your social media accounts, Quentin, and in particular, your Instagram is just so positive and uplifting and beautiful.
Thanks.
I really love it. And if you're an Instagram user, go follow iGrow Chicago right now.
Right now.
Right this minute. So again, I'll tweet that out too. So I want to talk about some of the programs because you really do a lot. We were talking a little bit about the sustainability and urban farming that mm-hmm. you're doing there near the Peace House that you have in Inglewood, which again, I want to say that you personally refinished this house with your own bare hands. You didn't job that out. Right. But also you have a really interesting mentorship and skill building program that that kind of breaks into a few different parts that includes a youth program over the summer. And that's coming up here July 10th through August 19th, a summer camp program for kids.
Yes, it is. This will be the fourth year where we do this called the Summer of Hope. And again, you know, it's the summertime. You know, some kids don't have a park dishes to go, or, you know, maybe it's tough for the parents to get them to, you know, to a camp, you know, because it's so many miles away. But again, this camp is free of charge. We take in 45 kids. I wish we could take a lot more.
Maybe one day.
Yes, we definitely will get there. But this is our fourth year, and they'll be going on different field trips every Thursday, you know, to like the Maggie Daly Park, you know, just get a different exposure to other environments, you know, for our kids. And a quick story, last year during the camp, we went on a field trip to the Maggie Daly Park, right? And, you know, when you come up Lakeshore, you know, you see the beautiful, you know, water, you see, you know, individuals jogging, you see the big boats, you know, you can see the pier. And right, and so we ordered a bus and went down there. And so when we was getting off the bus, you know, there's the kids. I said, you know, get your seatbelts off. You know, we're here. We at our destination. Two of the kids stood up, and they goes, "Are we out of town?" Now, imagine, we only 10 minutes away from 64th and Arnie. We're only 10 minutes away. Downtown is not a huge drive, depending on traffic. But sure. Again, they asked, "Are we downtown?" I said, "No, we're just downtown." They didn't know that we had boats, and they didn't know there was, you know, beautiful water over there. So again, right, just getting them a different exposure, you know.
Sure.
And that touched me, you know, to know that. Oh, wow.
Yeah. What is the age group with the Summer of
the
Hope
age
camp?
Group is from 5 to 12. And that would be and I'm actually we're gonna host like different face painting, yoga and basketball, just different, again, just so many different activities for the kids where they could come, where they could play, where they could build new bonds with friends, and again, just giving them something to do for the summer.
Sure.
You know, no
sure.
doubt.
Sure. There's a picture I saw on one of your social media accounts of this really cute little girl just covered in yellow paint, and she looked like she was having so much fun just kind of playing it with your with all of your art programs that you do.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, man. They love the art. Kids love the art. You know, I think she got some of my pens, but she knows she is.
Right.
Just kidding. But they love it.
But then in addition to this, you also offer some services that are really, really essential. There's a community pantry, there's mm-hmm. laundry services, and a community kitchen for people that need that.
Yes, so any day, Monday through Friday, the community knows, and if anyone who's listening in, Monday through Friday, we have a food pantry. We have a pantry where you can come get toiletries, again, free of charge, whether there's diapers, toothbrush, toothpaste, tissue, body wash, detergent, you know,
whatever
it is, you know, the household toiletries. And we get these through different donations, through people doing this out of kindness of their heart, you know, because to serve, you know, you don't do it for your own purpose. You have to do it, you know, from the heart, from the compassion. So, again, I appreciate everyone who has been a huge support to Agro Chicago. And we could definitely going to continue to strive. But definitely Monday through Friday, food pantry, and any household items that you need.
Which is so essential, because if you don't have those basic things covered,
it's hard to move forward.
Yeah, you definitely can't get anything else.
You know, it's definitely hard to move forward. You know, you can say, hey, you know, go out and get a job, you know, give a person some information, say go get a job. Well, if that person doesn't have transportation to even get to that job,
Or hasn't eaten today,
you know, are you going to choose to go to the job, or you just say, hey, I'm starving? You can't make it to the job on an empty stomach, you know? And what we tell our kids, you know, to go to school, test well, you know, to be great. But on an empty stomach, it's hard to do that, you know. So, again, we definitely will continue, you know, to be a huge helping hand to the community, you know, especially from where I'm from. It's a must. We have to.
Yeah. And there's also a restorative justice and community building aspect to this that is so very interesting. It's really facilitating a lot of dialogue with community partners that I think is really fascinating, particularly the restorative justice angle. I mean, I think that's something we're hearing more about in the legal system. I don't think quickly enough or enough of it, but one that's really so, so very, very important. But I want to talk a bit about how yoga has impacted you, because it's something that it really trickles through the website. There's, you know, as you're looking around at all the different programs with iGrow Chicago on igrowchicago.org, the theme of yoga is throughout. Even when you're looking at the farming part and the mentorship part, it seems that yoga has really touched and impacted your life so much that you really want to, it seems like you really want to share it with others.
I mean,
because it's daily, right? You're a daily yoga practitioner.
Yes, it is. But due to my injury right now.
Right. Guy's coming here with this cool shirt that says rewrite history. But then he's got this giant, you know, cast on his arm.
Freak accident playing ball. But again,
you'll be back at the handstands in no time.
I could try. Maybe some kids could teach me, or somebody else out there could teach me. But definitely. Yoga has definitely, you know, been a key piece. You know, it's just a sense. And it's not just, you know, just doing the moves, you know, just on your mat. It's more so what you do off your mat. You know, anybody can be a teacher anywhere, but can you teach on and off the mat? You know, so again, it's just a place where I go to, you know, to get some, you know, a peace of mind. You know, we all, again, for all the individuals out there who's doing so much good things in Englewood, so much good things throughout the city of Chicago, you know, we have to get, you know, a peace of mind for our own sake. You know, I'm not good, or I can't pour 100% into an individual if I'm not whole myself. So again, just going to that space where I can, you know, shut off my phone, you know, don't have to, you know, be on social media, you know, no phone calls, no texts, and just, you know, sit still and just be at peace with myself and, you know, to reflect on things. And that's what yoga has helped me do. And it's been great.
As my grandmother likes to say, you can't pour from an empty cup.
You can't.
You have to take care of yourself if you're going to serve others.
Self-care,
definitely. Which is so important. But then you have a training program for others who want to teach yoga or deepen their own practice.
Yes. So I just recently got back from Africa, and I was there doing a 200-hour service project, and beautiful people over at AYP, African Yoga Project. Myself and a few other of my coworkers had got certified in this piece, so it's been great. And we definitely after summer camp, after August 19th, we're going to host a yoga training there at the house. So anyone out there who's listening, you know, go on the website, go to Agro Chicago, see how can you get involved, you know, with the yoga. And just kind of, you know, be a helping hand, be a support. If you want to come by, you're more than welcome to be a part of the training.
I love the very welcoming spirit that you have with everything that you do at iGrow. It's very much like whatever you need, if you need food, if you need laundry, if you need yoga, if you need a minute.
I mean, because again, I know, like, you know, coming from, like, I understand, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, and I understand that feeling, you know, to not have, you know, to go without, you know, to go without, you know, food, to go without, you know, clothes. But without all of that, I still had compassion, though, no matter what. You know, I didn't care about it, you know. Did I bug mom about the latest Nikes? Of course I did, you know, growing up, you know. And she worked hard to try to provide those, you know, our needs, you know, and she did a great job at it. So I have to play a significant part of pointing into my people, you know, and pointing to everyone who I encounter, you know. I might touch them from just a conversation, you know, and vice versa too as well, you know. So again, I try to be open to any and everybody, especially when it's positive, no doubt.
Indeed, indeed. And you're doing so much to this. I mean, this organization is so interesting. Again, everybody head to igrowchicago.org and you will immediately see just such a positive and loving message on the website. There's so much positivity. And I'm sure right now people are listening thinking, okay, I'm in. How do I support this organization? I know there's a donation button right there on the website.
Yes,
so people
it, yeah.
can donate that way. But what about volunteers and time?
Yeah, I mean, for anyone who is listening right now, come out. Our location is 6402 South Honorary. We there Monday through Friday. Come out, you know, even if it's the smallest donation, you know, from a toothbrush, from whatever. If you have skills at, you know, helping individuals with jobs, if you have skills at mock interviews, whatever skill set that you have, we open any and everyone to come out and be a part of this change we so much need in our world today. You know, be the change that you want to see in the world, you know, and that's the motto. We have to be the ones to do it, you know. So, again, get up, get out, and touch somebody. Please, just touch somebody. They waiting on you. They waiting on the call. So come out and be a part of it. Come be a part of history. You know, we're going to continue to keep striving. We're going to continue to keep striving for greatness. So anyone's listening, come check out the Peace House, Agro Chicago, you know, and see in which ways that you can be a huge support and be a key piece, to this puzzle.
Indeed. And I can personally vouch for you. It is a beautiful, beautiful place. And it's just so colorful and like painted so beautifully. And there's so much art and cool stuff around. So everybody head to igrowchicago.org. You can find out all about the stuff that Quentin Mables, our guest, who is co-executive director of the organization. You can find out all the stuff that he's doing, the yoga programs, the mentorship, the sustainability and urban farming, all the stuff. You can find out all about that there and how you can support this organization. And again, we're going to tweet that out and put that on the website. Thank you so much for being with us tonight, Quentin.
Thanks for having me, Amy. If you don't stand for nothing, we'll fall for anything.
Indeed. Indeed. So we're going to take a little break, get to the news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. And as ever, we pick one big topic and we spend the whole evening talking about it and many different aspects of it. And that topic tonight, we are looking at programs right here in Chicago that benefit children. There are so many ways to support kids right here in Chicago and around the world, and so important that we do so, indeed, the most vulnerable of the population. And so we are joined in studio right now by Rita Kikoen. She is the owner of Engineering for Kids Chicagoland. Rita, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mamie.
Thanks so much for being with us tonight. I appreciate you taking time out of your holiday weekend to join us and tell us about your organization. And so, as the name implies, Engineering for Kids at Chicagoland is all about, I assume, a lot of STEM empowerment, which is something we talk about a lot on this program. But how do you talk about your organization?
Well, Engineering for Kids is kind of like an extension of what I did my entire life. I was in technology, and a very unknown, back in the 70s, I got into technology, and I was very fortunate to get into it. And I just love watching these children getting involved in hands-on work, science, technology, engineering, and math. And I think that it's something that we need to encourage children at a very young age to do. So I'm even going one step further. My company is Women in STEM. And so what I am doing is I'm trying to encourage toddlers to ages 2 and 3. We're actually going to be starting some mom and dad and tot classes. And that's really, I did a survey online to see what the whether the parents are interested in this. The survey blew me away. That everybody is like, yes, please. Where? When are you going to start? When's it going to start? What? How much is it going to cost? They really want to do it.
How interesting! I can't even. I don't even know what I would begin to teach a tiny little, like a 2 or 3 year old, about STEM.
You know what? You would be amazed. We actually went to a nursery school in Oak Brook called Bright Start, and we taught them how to make little bridges with marshmallows and toothpicks.
How cute.
I love it. It was really amazing. And they were, you know, 2, 3 year old children, and they loved it.
So there's their engineering lesson.
That's
with
right.
Marshmallows and toothpicks.
That's right.
I love it. That's super cute. And so because you have this focus, particularly women in STEM, it's such a big topic, right? When we talk about getting girls in STEM, because some people say, oh, it's about empowering them. Some people say, oh, they're empowered enough. It's about keeping them interested and feeling safe and welcome once they're in it. And there's so many layers, and it gets really complicated, I think, the older you get. And, you know, I remember a study we talked about on the program probably about a year ago about how, okay, we've done an okay job getting girls into STEM, but then once women enter the workforce, it's hard to keep them in technology fields. So it seems like such a big task with a lot of narratives attached to it. Where do you even start that?
You know, it's really difficult to, I think part of the thing is that most of the classes, people, they see a lot of men or boys, I should say, in high school and college enrolling in these fields, computer science, you know, whether it's technology, telecommunications. And I think that the girls get a little, you know, shy. They shy away from it a little bit. And that's why I think engineering for kids is the best thing for them, because then they're in classes. And I have, honestly, I get a very almost equal enrollment of boys and girls. And you know what? The girls do just as well, if not sometimes better. They have that organizational automatically, that I think that thought process is a little more natural to them, and they just don't realize it. But I get them in there and they just shine.
I love that. And I love hearing that they're doing just as well, if not better, which I have long suspected anyway. And so how did you first come to this organization and get involved with it?
Well, this is really a very cute story. I have a grandson who is 10 years old. And last year, he always looking for some kind of a special birthday party for his birthday. And I thought, just out of the blue, I just Googled Minecraft birthday party, thinking I was going to find nothing. And I actually found something. I was able to put together a Minecraft birthday party for him with Engineering for Kids. Well, when I went and saw it, I literally went and flew out to Virginia, where Engineering for Kids is corporate headquarters is, and I bought the franchise that next week.
You're not playing around.
No, I was not playing around. And my grandson, his name is Chase, and he never fails to remind me, Grandma, you know you do engineering for kids because of me.
Oh, you owe your success to me, Grandma.
I owe the success to Chase.
How funny. And so what do you feel like, you know, every issue and every industry kind of has its dominant narratives attached to it. What are some of those some of the things you just wish people understood better about getting kids involved in STEM that perhaps gets lost in the main, you know, narrative?
Well, I think one of the things is I think people need to realize that the United States falls behind. And I know that you know this, Amy, is that we are falling behind as far as introducing STEM education and really graduating the technology and engineering people out of our colleges. It's not happening as well as it should. I think I've read many articles from Microsoft and Google, the big companies. They're concerned. They're concerned that they're not going to get the students out of the United States, that they want to fill the positions that are coming up with everything that they have on their goals to do.
Indeed. Yeah. I think a lot of the times we think of a lot of people say things like, oh, kids are always, they always have their heads in their phones and they're so, you know, it's the digital generation. They know how to do all that, but not necessarily, you know, just because you can operate an Apple product really well doesn't necessarily mean you can, you have started any kind of education in that field.
Right. And one of the things that we do, honestly, when we're starting to do any of our STEM classes, we start with engineering. We start with aerospace engineering, electrical engineering. We don't start with the, at least I don't in my business, I don't start with the tech things because I want them to realize that engineering can be so much more than that. I want them to learn the engineering design process, how to actually take a thought and make it into a product, because that's what our engineers do, and we still need that. You know, it doesn't matter if things are being built overseas. We still need people graduating to think that way. And so that's what we start first, is teaching them how to think that way.
And that's, I'm sure, a great foundation for the other parts of STEM that, you know, you would go into from there.
Right. Absolutely.
Indeed. We're talking with Rita Kikoen. She is the owner of Engineering for Kids Chicagoland. We're talking all about her organization and how it's serving children right here in Chicago. We're going to take a little break and continue this conversation in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. We're talking all about programs for kids right here in Chicago, all kinds of programs. There are so many we looked at leading up to this show, but we are talking with four different organizations tonight, and we're going to be sure and share all of their info with you after the program and put it on the WGNradio.com website so you can find it and connect with these organizations that are really doing such cool and fun and positive things for young people right here in our communities. We have with us in studio right now Rita Kikoen. She's the owner of Engineering for Kids Chicagoland. And I just love this, everything you're saying about this program. It sounds so fun. And I at first I thought, how in the world could you get a kid that little involved in engineering? And I was looking at the curriculum on your website, and it seems intimidating. It seems, you know, very intimidating. Aerospace, environmental, industrial, chemical, mechanical, electrical, marine, civil. That's a lot of stuff that could be a little terrifying, but you tackle this with very young kids.
Well, the good thing is the curriculum is based on certain age groups. So what we call our junior engineers are ages 4 to 7. Our apprentice engineers are ages 7 to 11. And then our advanced engineers are ages 12 to 14. And our curriculum is, you know, it's based on that. So we have aerospace curriculum for all ages. But the little ones are going to do, they're going to do similar activities, but maybe not as difficult. Their motor skills aren't as fine yet, and they may not be able to read. So the one thing that we do is they learn vocabulary. And I will tell you that, you know, mothers call me and tell me, with their four-year-old child, will walk up to them and say, "Do you know what gravity is, Mom?"
That's so
and
cute.
It is just so adorable. And mothers call me and thank me because many classes that you might think of that, or that they might take, they might try to kind of teach it to them so that they not, you know, I don't want to say dumb it down.
Right, but soften the words,
but they
or
soften
shy
the
away.
Words. Well,
yeah.
We don't really do that. We let them learn what gravity is by showing them and teaching them, and so they learn all the words that an aerospace engineer would use or an electrical engineer. And I'll tell you, I just am so happy when I watch these children, because they come into this class and they're just so excited to make something and build something. By class 2 or 3, they're telling me what the words are and what they mean, so it's really great.
They're keeping you in check.
They are.
That's very cute. And you have summer programs, too. Tell us about those.
We do. We have chosen some really cool places to have summer programs. So, for instance, last week we just finished up a class at the Sky Zone in Orland Park, and it was on forensic science. So they were actually doing DNA analysis, and they were doing crash site investigations, and it was just a lot of fun. And the best part about it is after our class, being in our class for 3 hours, then they can go jump in the Sky Zone, get
sure.
let off some steam.
Right.
But so we've got some really good, we've hooked up with Sky Zone. We do teach at the children's museums, both in Frankfurt and in Oak Lawn. And we teach at some of the Mathnasiums in Oak Brook and Hinsdale. So we partner with some people that are really also giving the kids a lot of benefit.
Yeah, that are very aligned with the mission intellectually, for sure. And so we touched on a little bit of girls in STEM and the myriad issues and narratives attached to that. But I was very heartened to hear that you say that it's pretty equal in your classes and that girls are excelling just fine in them, which is what we need to hear. So when you look ahead and even maybe 5-10 years down the road, the conversations we're having about young people in STEM, how do you hope to see those change and evolve?
I really do hope to see more girls getting involved in STEM. I hope to see more graduate engineers in or whether it be technical or aerospace or any of our disciplines of engineering. I hope to see more girls doing that. And I really do promote that. Any event I go to, I tend to kind of bring the girls in and I would say, you know, hey, this is really cool. Do you enjoy this? And so I'm doing my part in trying to get the girls more involved.
Excellent. That's what we need. We need more advocates doing more and more of that work. And so tell us a little bit about the kind of the logistics and stuff. So you have both after school and evening programs, correct?
Yes. Engineering for Kids, and this goes for probably all the locations of Engineering for Kids, which they're in 150 locations nationwide in about 26 countries. The majority of them do not have a facility. So what we do is we reach out to schools, private and public, and we bring our programs to as an after-school program. So I'm aligned with many schools right now, which is awesome. We also, with the evening and Saturday programs, I find facilities like Sky Zone or like Mathnasium that let us use their space, you know, to be able to hold our classes.
And what would you say the biggest maybe challenge facing young people entering STEM? I mean, we've talked a little bit about gender roles and gender dynamics there, but that aside, are there other barriers? We talked earlier in the conversation about how the United States is really falling behind and other countries are doing so much more to educate kids in STEM fields. What can we do to shore that up, and what other things are kind of on your mind about this?
Well, you know, it really boils down to getting them involved at an early age so that when they're in high school or they're going to college, they know what this type of, whether it's science, technology, engineering, math, they understand the importance of it in our world and what they can do to make the world better by utilizing that those types of skills. I think we need to get them, like I said, that's why I want to do these 2- and 3-year-olds even, get them involved very early so that they want to do it, so that it's not something that somebody's asking them if they want to do. They go through junior high school and say, this is what I really want to do.
And how can people get involved in your organization?
Well, they can go on my website or call me, and we've got most of our classes listed. Are you asking about coming to my classes?
All of the things, all the ways people are, because that's, here's what I know about my listeners. They want to know all the different ways to get involved in something and have lots of options. So that's what I
am
them.
Really looking for parent advocates. Because how I've gotten into some of the public schools, it is difficult to get in because there are a lot of different options that are available to the schools as far as after-school programs.
Sure.
You know, there's chess club, there's, you know, many things. But I'm looking for parent advocates, parents that understand how the important STEM is, and they talk to their principals, whether it's through the PTO organizations or how, you know, they need to say, hey, let's call Engineering for Kids and talk to them about bringing these programs to us after school.
Excellent. Okay, so we are going to share links to your website and social media and all of that. But we let's see, you're on Twitter and Facebook and all the places.
Mostly Facebook and my website.
Okay, so we're going to, everybody head to this organization, Engineering for Kids Chicagoland. There's a few. There's several out there. So make sure it's the Chicagoland one. And you can connect with this organization on Facebook. And of course, you can find a link right there to the website. And you can get in touch with our guest, Rita Kikoen, who is the owner of Engineering for Kids Chicagoland. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Amy, thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Any anything that's, I love STEM topics, and I'm so glad you could be with us tonight. It's so important, especially I'm delighted to hear the report on getting more girls in STEM at a young age. Very, yep. Very important, and something I talk about an awful lot. Regular listeners will know. All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. As ever, we pick one big topic and we unpack that topic all evening long with a variety of experts looking at different aspects of that topic. So tonight we are talking about programs for children, and we've been talking with some local organizations that do work with children right here in Chicagoland, but we're going to shift that focus a little bit and look at an organization that's doing really essential and important work to serve children, in fact, around the world. Because as we've been talking about tonight, children are indeed some of the most vulnerable of our population, and it's so important to serve and protect them, especially children who are underserved and underrepresented. And so this organization really, really is doing very, very impactful work. So please welcome to the program Charity Ryerson. She is a human rights attorney and the founder of Corporate Accountability Lab. And in a world where it's the exception that corporations are held accountable for various crimes and things that they commit overseas, she fights to bring justice to victims through innovative legal strategies that help create a more sustainable and human-centered economy. Charity, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Amy.
Thanks for being with us. And so tell us about Corporate Accountability Lab. It's really, there's a lot of, just even looking around the website, very cursory glance, there's some really very big, large issues that you're tackling.
Yeah, we're definitely in an unusual space. We're a bit of a niche organization in some ways, but I think that over time, the mission that we're charting out, this process that we're developing, is something that will become more common as people understand the importance of it in the increasingly globalized economy. So what we do is we focus on the gaps in legal remedies available to victims around the world, particularly when they're harmed by U.S. companies. So if a U.S. company has a plantation or a factory or a mine overseas and they harm people, it could be their workers, it could be folks who live around those operations, it could be environmental harms, they're often able to come back to the United States and have no penalty for that, so they can escape liability entirely. So we're looking at different ways to repurpose existing laws so that we can hold companies accountable when they commit those kinds of crimes.
So it's really just looking all the way down the supply chain, more or less. And I feel like there's some areas of industry that have done that pretty well. It seems like coffee tackled that pretty quickly. I think the diamond industry and jewelry, we hear about that, like the conflict-free diamond, things like that. But in fact, this really is much more far-reaching than that.
It is much more far-reaching. And I think that, you know, those strategies that you raise to address some of these problems, like certification programs, monitoring systems, have been very important both to identify the extent to which these abuses are ongoing. It's very easy in a globalized economy to miss what's really happening, to see all the way down that supply chain. And so those programs have done a lot, including corporate codes of conduct and corporate voluntary initiatives have been a huge deal. Unfortunately, they have not even come close to remediating the problems that exist in these supply chains. And they're widespread across region and industry. Certainly in coffee, I think that, you know, the fair trade coffee movement has made a lot of progress. And you see that in a few other industries. But right now, the way that the global economy is structured, there is an incentive on corporations to commit these abuses and for them to continue. So unless we change things structurally, we're not going to change the continued existence of these types of problems.
If you could say a little more about that incentive, because that seems counterintuitive at first glance until you're really immersed in this topic a lot.
Right. Well, why don't I give an example, and we can sort of shift this to children a little bit, and you'll see how this works. So one of the cases that we've been working on, or new legal strategies that we've been developing, has to do with children in the West African cocoa industry. So child labor is a huge problem around the world. The International Labor Organization says there's about 150 million child laborers. Of those, about 5.5 million are children. About 5.5 million are forced child laborers. So those are usually kids that are trafficked from other countries. And I want to distinguish forced child labor from the kind of child labor where a parent will bring their kid to work with them. Mm-hmm. That can sometimes have some educational value. And so while I'm not condoning that practice, I'm just going to say we're focusing on forced child labor as a different type of child labor that is more pernicious, more problematic for children. So in this industry, so 2.1 million of these forced child laborers are working in the West African cocoa industry. So these are kids that are producing for Hershey's and Nestle, usually through supplier plantations, cocoa plantations. And about a month ago, we have a close partner of ours, Terry Collingsworth at International Rights Advocates, was doing some investigation on a case that he has against Nestle for child labor in West Africa. And he was in Ivory Coast, and he walked up on some of these plantations and found just exactly as many child laborers as there have ever been. So he found trafficked children from Burkina Faso, from Mali. He interviewed them. Got statements. They were, you know, average 10 years old, walking around with machetes, cutting cocoa to produce chocolate for the U.S. market. Now, that's extraordinary, right? We have laws on the books in the United States that prohibit the importation of any product made with forced or child labor. So how is this happening that despite voluntary initiatives, every chocolate company has a code of conduct, there's laws on the books, you know, it seems like the whole infrastructure, everything that you could possibly do program-wise to stop this has been done, mm-hmm. and yet it continues. End of the day, companies are only willing to pay so much. And so one thing that we found doing investigations in China where, you know, shoes made for major U.S. brands were found to be made in prisons. People said, how is it possible that a major U.S. brand is producing in a Chinese prison? Well, the answer is they're only going to pay their suppliers so much. So if it goes above that, they think they're not going to be competitive in the global economy. And so by keeping those prices that low, then their supplier is going to contract out to a prison, or their supplier is going to buy trafficked children from across the border. And it's going to continue until it's not an option. And I think that's really the fundamental facet of our economy that makes this possible, is that it's possible. If this were something like, imagine a product safety regime in the United States, right? If there was kids' toys with lead, what happens? They get pulled from the shelves, or they get stopped at the border. Once you find out that something's made with lead and it's going into to a kid, it's stopped. You deprive them of market access. If we did that for use of forced child labor, if you said, oh, we found out that this product is essentially poisoned by the use of forced child labor, it would dry up.
Sure.
They'd fix it. They would find a way to fix it. All these programs aren't fixing it, and that's because they don't have to fix it.
That is, it's so fascinating and heartbreaking to see how easy it could be. But also, immediately I'm struck with a huge sense of guilt of what is in my house right now that possibly could have, you know, could have been from a company that is partaking in this way and exploiting young people. And so how can a consumer be smart about this when, in fact, even U.S. regulatory organizations are not necessarily on it in this way?
Well, there are things that you can do, but I think that part of the part of what's important here is recognizing that we can't have clean hands, right? We live in an economy where clean hands are not an option. And so I think that making good consumer choices certainly pushes us in that direction. You know, when you buy bananas, buy fair trade or whole trade bananas. You know, don't buy the regular Chiquita and Dole bananas. It's a very bad industry. You know, there's a lot of different products that are certified, and you can look for those certifications, and that will take you part of the way there. You can buy used clothing. You can, you know, go online to some of those used clothing shops online if you want to. There's a lot of options now to make your purchasing decisions a little bit more sustainable, but that only goes so far. I think that a next step from there is we write letters to the companies that we shop from. We make sure that they know that we know. We aren't just choosing not to buy that chocolate bar because we think it might be made with child labor. We're in fact sending a letter to that company and say, I almost bought that chocolate bar, but I decided to instead buy the Fairtrade certified chocolate bar next to it because I'm concerned about your use of child labor. And that's, you know, again, that's not going to fix the problem. I think that if over time, socially, culturally, if we become increasingly intolerant of these things, then the legislation that matches that intolerance might catch up.
Indeed. See, there's so much to think about here. And as ever, we scratch the surface on a topic and start unpacking it, and it gets complicated quickly. But that's why it's so important that organizations like yours exist. And so what was the original idea behind your organization, Corporate Accountability Lab? And how did it kind of, what is the origin story there of how it came to be?
Yeah. Well, so I got started in the student anti-sweatshop movement, so I've been interested in supply chains for many, many years. I did some labor monitoring in Latin America, mostly on coffee and banana and flower plantations in Central America and the Andean region, and then went to law school, really focusing on trying to figure out why these corporate codes of conduct weren't working. Because I was on plantations for, you know, Chiquita bananas and Dole bananas, and I saw things that were absolutely violations of their codes of conduct repeatedly. And the question is, well, the code exists, right? They commit to do a list of things, and this includes prohibitions on child labor in almost every corporate code, and yet they're not applied. So I went to law school to say, well, how are we going to, you know, where's the teeth? How are we going to make this work? After law school, I worked on cases against U.S. companies for really egregious human rights abuses. So it was torture, murder, extrajudicial killing. Those cases were all under one statute that was struck down, or not exactly struck down, it was greatly limited by the Supreme Court in 2013. And so that means that since 2013, there's been this incredible gap in corporate accountability in the United States. So our laws just don't provide remedies to victims of U.S. companies overseas anymore. And we've really seen how that's played out in the last 4 years, and it just gets worse and worse. And so we started Corporate Accountability Lab really with a laser focus on this gap, on this problem, on why our laws allow this country to be a safe haven for abusive companies. And so what we do is we repurpose the laws that corporations use for their own benefit, like contract, intellectual property, international trade law, and we try to use those back against those companies rather than relying on human rights and environmental statutes that have been really destroyed by the companies in this litigation.
No small task right there. No small task. We're talking with Charity Ryerson, who is a founder of Corporate Accountability Lab. And although we have been looking at Chicago organizations during tonight's program that are supporting children in Chicago, here is an organization right here in Chicago that has pivoted and is looking out for children around the world. You have heard her describing some really, really egregious things, child labor and that sort of thing, particularly forced child labor. And so we're talking about that and looking at that. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we will continue this conversation with Charity Ryerson of Corporate Accountability Lab. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. And as ever, we pick one big topic and we spend the entire evening talking about it. And that topic tonight has been about organizations here in Chicago that are doing really important work to serve children, not just in Chicago, but in fact around the world, because I think we can all agree children are the most vulnerable of the population, and it's so important to serve their needs, whether they are very basic ones like safety, food, and shelter, all the way to bigger issues like encouragement and support and all of that. So we have been talking about a variety of things this evening. We have in studio with us right now Charity Ryerson, who is a human rights attorney and founder of Corporate Accountability Lab. And we've been talking about some really serious issues impacting children around the world. Thanks for staying with us and continuing this conversation, Charity. This is really such important work that you're doing. And we've been talking a lot about how this global economy has fostered a lot of this, and looking at transnational companies and laws and all of these big things. And I have to wonder if, as these checks and balances are kind of getting lost in the supply chain, where everyday household companies are getting away with either intentionally or without knowing human rights violations, especially as they apply to children and enforced child labor. How is international law not catching some of that and dealing with some of it? Or does it skirt it in a different way that we're not thinking of?
You know, I think that is a common misconception about international law, that it has the ability to catch these transnational harms. So domestic legal systems are assumed to be sufficient to handle particularly corporate crime. So, you know, for example, when the International Criminal Court was created, in the Rome Statute that created the International Criminal Court, it explicitly excluded corporations. So they said, well, you know, the United States, for example, has the Alien Tort Statute, which is that the statute that was limited by the Supreme Court in 2013. That should be enough. Companies should be able to just go back to where they're from, and they'll be held accountable there. The reality is that there's this process of passing the ball between international institutions and domestic institutions, or between one country and another. So in this case, for example, like let's just say for this Ivory Coast case with the child laborers, what could happen if you tried to bring a case in the United States is that you would wind up coming up against a jurisdictional argument, pushing it to the Ivory Coast and into their court system rather than having it heard in our court system, simply because the underlying acts took place in the Ivory Coast. So you have this problem where a lot of these cases never make it to the merits because of this constant passing the ball, and so they get dismissed on jurisdictional grounds. That has created this situation, and I think that over time, international law or international institutions have started to see that more and more, but they just don't have the jurisdiction over a lot of our institutions. So insofar as the United States doesn't want to be a safe haven for its own company, which is for its own companies that are committing abuses, which is to say the United States is the one place in the world that we know that our corporations could be held accountable because we have personal jurisdiction over them here. So nowhere else in the world are we assured personal jurisdiction like we are here. So that difference between domestic and international law has created a lot of, I would say, confusion and really belief that there is someone else who's going to do the job, and no one else is doing it. Hmm. So it's part of why we need to bring it home. We need to find ways here under our laws to hold them accountable.
Indeed. And as I said before the break, no small task for your organization. And so if we were to look, you know, 5, 10, 15 years ahead, what would your hope be of reasonable progress that could be made in these areas in that time frame?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one thing that is not our hope right now, just to start there, is having short-term legislative fixes to this. So really the answer to this problem is federal, like comprehensive federal legislation. That's how you would fix this, right? That's for so many reasons not happening right now. I don't think that the Trump administration is particularly interested in corporate accountability. I don't think that Congress is particularly interested in corporate accountability. And so getting federal legislation on this particular topic, considering corporate lobbyists and campaign financing issues, et cetera, seems pretty unlikely. So in the next 15 years, what would we like to see? Well, looking at it, maybe it's even a longer game strategy. So for one, if we're looking just specifically at children's rights, there is a UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. Now, the United States, out of the group of countries that was eligible to sign on, the US is the only one that did not. So there's over 190 signatories to that. So why did the U.S. not sign on? It's kind of interesting story. So I think there's a lot of different reasons, but two of the reasons were that the U.S. would be in violation of that convention if it were to sign on, because at the time, and this was in the 90s, we still had juvenile death penalty and we still had life without parole for juvenile offenders. For a developed country like the United States, that's pretty surprising that we had it as long as we did. Now, both of those are now gone. The Supreme Court has chucked both of those out, thankfully. But that, you know, I think in the global community, that was perceived as being extraordinarily cruel. And the impact of that is that when we don't sign on to these conventions, that means that we don't have an obligation to create implementing legislation. So if we sign it and ratify it, that's great. It's just sort of a commitment. But what we're supposed to do is to then implement it through legislation that allows us to actually do it in our country in some way. So we don't have that implementing legislation. We don't have that implementing legislation for a lot of conventions that are broadly accepted. And where we do have it, so for example, the Torture Victim Protection Act, excuse me, the Torture Victim Protection Act is the domestic legislation that implements the Convention Against Torture.
Right.
So that's a great example of how it could be done. But in 2012, the Supreme Court decided that that act doesn't apply to corporations. So There's potential here of combining international and U.S. law, or integrating more international law into U.S. law, that will give us the ability to create remedies in the U.S. for victims of U.S. companies, and so to create those deterrents. But that's kind of a long road. Yeah. So as a shorter term solution, what we're trying to do is we're trying to use international trade law and unusual forums to hold them accountable. So our strategy right now for these West African cocoa workers.
I've made you talk so much today. I'm so interested in all the things you're saying. I'm so sorry.
Our strategy for these West African cocoa workers is we're looking at designing a new strategy that no one's ever done before, where we would use this underutilized statute that prohibits the importation of goods made with unfair trade practices. So we want to try to characterize child labor and forced child labor as an unfair trade practice. Essentially to say, so we would put like a fair trade chocolate company against a non-fair trade chocolate company that was using forced child labor and make it an unfair competition case in international trade law. So that's a very, it's an interesting and unusual strategy. And the remedy there, one possible remedy would be exclusion, which is to say a blockade. They couldn't come in to the U.S. market. We would deprive producers of child labor produced cocoa of market access in the United States.
And indeed, that, as you said at the beginning of our conversation, it's so much about market access and speaking with dollars. And really, as you're talking, I'm thinking so much about organizations and governments, particularly our current administration, not being as supportive of corporate accountability. And really, that comes down to dollars in so many cases. And how do we solve for that? And how do we meld, and align the goals of, you know, the capitalist goal, which, like it or not, there we are, with that accountability and the very human one. And it's no small task, but indeed, Corporate Accountability Lab is tackling this very important topic, particularly with all issues, but particularly with children and how forced labor in particular, which is so very important, especially as all the topics have come together tonight around helping children and companies here in Chicago doing so. And so how, as we're unfortunately running out of time, how can people support and get involved with your organization?
Yeah, you can check out our website, which is just legaldesign.org. We could certainly use donations. This is a very hard type of work to fund because we're not direct services. We're legal strategy development, so we're in a very unusual niche. We also have some strategies that I won't belabor right now, but that relate to intellectual property. So if you're a creator of intellectual property, which is to say a writer, artist, musician, software developer, scientist, etc., you might be able to condition the use of your intellectual property on human rights and environmental conditions. So check out our website for a little bit more information about that and to get updates as we roll that out.
Very, very interesting. And again, all the people that you heard from tonight all have really fascinating websites and lots of resources on them. So we're going to include all of those websites, links to all of those websites on WGNRadio.com, and I'll be sure to tweet them out personally. So you can follow me on Twitter, and I'll also post them on Facebook. So connect with me there and look at WGNRadio.com, and you will find them all. Charity Ryerson of Corporate Accountability Lab, thank you so much for being with us tonight. I feel like I could talk with you for hours about all this stuff. It's so very interesting. But
thanks, Amy.
Kudos to you for this really important work that you're doing. And thank you to all of my guests this evening.